Welcome to The Bone Beat, conversations on health policy issues affecting musculoskeletal care and supporting advocacy efforts to advance access and quality. Brought to you by the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons. Here's your host, Kristen Coltis.
Welcome to this special episode of The Bone Beat podcast. We're doing something we actually have not done before, and that is bringing on a panel of our members to talk about the bundle payments for care improvement advance model. For those of you who don't know, this is a voluntary value-based model from the CMS Innovation Center. We're going to be talking about that, as well as bundled payments more generally in the transition to value-based care. You might be wondering why now, why do this special episode? Well, there's two reasons. One, we've got many AOS members who are making the decision now whether or not they want to change their contracts for model year four. But there's also been a lot of news at a CMMI lately and discussion of whether or not these models could become more mandatory in the future. So I want to start by letting our guests introduce themselves and just briefly telling you about their involvement with BPCIA Advanced. Why don't you start, Dr. Gibson?
Oh, sure, Kristen, thank you. Thanks for having us. And I'm Wilfred Gibson. I'm an orthopedic surgeon in Virginia Beach in Norfolk and Chesapeake, Southampton Roads, Virginia. I'm also the advocacy council chair for AAOS. I've been involved initially with bundle payments from the beginning. I served on the board of directors, and it was something that was being discussed at the time back in 2012 or so. And when it started with BPCI, bundle payment care for improvement, traditional or classic, I was on board with a hospital system, and it just didn't work well. So now I'm involved with a convener, and it's been tremendously successful. That's who I am and why I'm hopeful that other orthopedic surgeons, our fellows, will recognize the tremendous value of this program and also be able to have the success that we have over the next 2 years, at least, with model year four that goes through December 31st, 2023.
And how about our incoming advocacy council chair? How about you, Dr. Douglas Lundy?
Hey, I'm Doug Lundy. I'm an orthopedic trauma surgeon in Atlanta, Georgia. I am immediate past president of Resurgence Orthopedics, which is a very large orthopedic practice in Metro Atlanta of 103 orthopedic surgeons and physiatrists. We have been involved with BPCI since the beginning and now BPCI Advanced. We are working through a convener, and we recently decided last week that we will opt out of BPCI starting 31 December 2020.
And Chris?
Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Finello. I'm the Director of Quality Improvement at Rothman Orthopedic Institute. We are also a large private practice of over 220 doctors. We operate out of three states going into our fourth state. We've been in the bundle payment business since 2015. We were in BPCI Original. We did very well in that program, which catapulted us into the commercial setting with value-based programs. And we hold 33 of those bundles in the Philadelphia market. We also were in BPCI Advanced, and we dropped out of the program in December 2019 because we didn't do as well as we had previously done in the first original program.
And our last panelist, Joel James from Signature.
Hi, Joel James, Signature Medical Group. We're a multi-specialty medical practice based in St. Louis, Missouri, with practices in the St. Louis and Kansas City metropolitan areas. Orthopedics is our largest service line. And we do have two orthopedic practices in Overland Park, Kansas. So actually, just across the border. We were pretty unique in BPCI. In Classic, the first BPCI program, we were the only orthopedic group that was also a convener, an awardee convener in BPCI that actually convened other independent orthopedic groups around the country, about 60 60 orthopedic groups in 26 states. So we ended up actually with the largest orthopedic bundle program in BPCI Classic, about 1,200 physicians doing, in total in the program, several hundred thousand joints over, the 5 years of the program. And it was very successful, by and large, for about 85% of the groups that were in the program. Because it was early, because there was a lot of opportunity out there for physicians to take a leadership role in managing a complete episode of cost, which they really hadn't had that opportunity to do before. And so we looked very much forward to not only being a medical group, an orthopedic group involved in BPCI Classic, but also a convener, and looked very much forward to BPCI Advanced, excited that they extended the program. But I have to say, and we can get more into that in the program, but it hasn't panned out as well for, especially for orthopedic groups that were in Classic that had already been able to reduce costs substantially and be rewarded for that. But the reduced target pricing in this program has left many groups disenchanted. Plus, they changed the, how they calculate target pricing in BPCI Advanced is vastly different from how they did it in Classic, and it's replete with problems. And at any rate, I think we're finding more and more groups have been kind of disenchanted with Advanced. We have some that have been very successful. And we'll continue the program, and others that will be exiting.
Well, we've got a great group with very different experiences and perspectives on these voluntary models, specifically BPCIA Advanced. I want to go to you, Dr. Gibson, as Advocacy Council Chair, and as you stated, someone whose practice is looking to stay in this program. Tell us about how this program has impacted AAOS members and how it's fared in terms of reaching its promise, its intent of reducing the cost of care without sacrificing quality.
You know, our AAOS strategic plan that we just approved about a year ago that goes through 2023 says our vision is we're the trusted leaders in advancing musculoskeletal health. So whatever we do, we want to maintain or improve quality, but we also want to be able to be good stewards and reduce cost. And that together improves value for our patients and the payers, including Medicare. One of our goals of the strategic plan was to equip our members to thrive in value-based environments and advance the quality of orthopedic care. So as the Advocacy Council Chair, I took this on as a responsibility. Clearly, our AAOS has supported these programs. We support voluntary programs. What we're not talking about tonight by design is the CJR, which came out perhaps about the same time, a little earlier, Comprehensive Care for Joint Replacement. Those were in metropolitan statistical areas, MSAs, and they were mandatory. And those have, and what I've seen and from hearing there are Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, CMMI speakers, they haven't done as well for saving Medicare money. And some of that has to do with the or misaligned goals with hospitals and physicians, in my experience, trying to work together. We came in, and I'm now shifting off my Advocacy Council Chair hat to my practice. Our practice, at first, we had no experience with this. It was difficult to convince a number of our partners that this is something we should look into and try to do. There were a number having tremendous success at the time, but a large number were not involved. And we sort of went in, tiptoed in, or, tested the water first with one of our hospital systems who had already selected their convener. Some of the problems are that hospitals have multiple bundles, so there's no focus on orthopedics or musculoskeletal. And I think that's, for me, part of the problem was it got so complicated. We had no idea what we were doing. It's retrospective, so we didn't know when the actions we took would take effect. And it was, and just to be quite honest, it was a mess. And the hospital later on, when we had BPCIA come about, we saw that as an opportunity to either do it as a physician group practice or with a convener. And we chose to do it with a convener, still not certain that we knew exactly what we were doing. But when they made BPCI, Bundled Payment for Care Improvement, advanced and advanced alternative payment model, you know, in the meantime, we were doing all these MIPS, merit-based incentive payment systems that I think all of us also knew those, you know, sprung from meaningful use and were, you know, really just a mess also. But this was the first that I saw that really had the opportunity to decrease cost and improve quality of care and therefore improve value. So it looked like a great thing. We signed up when it first came out, I believe in 2018. It was a 2-year deal. Then we were had sprung on us the 50% professional fee cap, which really killed it. It would have killed it for everyone. And we fought long and hard for the AAOS as well as our conveners together realized it would kill the program. So we made trips to Baltimore and visited with CMMI and CMS. And we finally got, you know, as best as we could, that 50% professional fee cap lifted so that the net patient reconciliation amounts could flow to the people that generated those savings, particularly the doctors, which is what I'm about as the advocacy council chair for the AAOS. I'm about our fellows. And so it works. And so as long as you implement the changes of care redesign and risk stratify your patients and risk and optimize their care prior to surgery, you will have better outcomes and the cost will be less for Medicare. And that's what my experience has been to the tune of, you know, our practice, the NIPRA for over a period of year, you know, what we targeted was for a 2-year cycle is a potential of a couple of million dollars. And we've come in pretty much pretty close to that. So I think it's a tremendous opportunity. Those who are dropping out, I'd be happy to speak to you, but I can tell you how you can make it work and how you can, at least while the program's still alive, generate cost savings and therefore gain sharing from Medicare for your practice.
Thanks, Dr. Gibson. I think that's a great segue into getting some others' take. Specifically, Dr. Lundy, you most recently decided to drop out. What were some of the considerations that you had in mind, given your experience with the program in the past?
One of the interesting things about bundled payments that I've learned is that things vary so substantially across the country. There is very little consistency in how each market works with this. Through the forum, we've gotten to know a lot of the other large groups in the country and tried to understand how they were using bundles of all different kinds, the commercial bundles, CJR, and BPCI. And their experience and our experience many times was quite different. One of the interesting things about the Atlanta market is that the payers, the commercial payers, are just not interested in bundles at all. And we have multiple times tried to engage with them. Hearing everything that was coming out of the association, we realized that we had to get in the bundled payment understanding in order to better survive as a group. And so BPCI was really the only methodology for us to really learn how to make our practice work with that. So we dove in the deep end and really did quite well under BPCI and then initially under BPCI Advanced. As Wilford was saying, we also have a convener. We felt that with everything on our plate, it was just smarter to go through it with that method. And we were going to continue in BPCI Advanced, but with the clinical episode service line groups coming in, we no longer could pick and choose which one of the specific bundles we wanted to be involved in. And when we looked at the service line group and what it would do with us overall, it quickly pushed us down into the red. And so as a result, we've decided that from a business perspective, we can't continue in this. We were getting pretty good at bundles and we were doing quite well as a group with it. But with the main issue was with the service line groups. One problem that we also have is that the target price really for whatever reason in Atlanta would quickly get decelerated down to a point that it was the dreaded race to the bottom that we all hear about. Some of our extremely efficient total joint surgeons were just, their margin was really pretty much shot after several pay periods of doing this.
And Chris, you said at the start that that Rothman had dropped out even longer. Did you say December of this past year?
Yes,
Chris. December of this past year. So do you share this similar sentiment as Dr. Lundy, or do you have a different perspective that you want to share with our orthopedic members?
No, I definitely have the same perspective of Dr. Lundy and Dr. Gibson. I think Dr. Lundy and I our practices are in the same situation. The BPCI initiative definitely has reduced Medicare costs, especially in the joint arthroplasty population. And as Dr. Gibson said, it really did improve outcomes as long as you did it the right way and not worried about just reducing costs, but reducing costs appropriately and managing utilization of post-operative services. But to that extent, you have to put infrastructure around that. And I think that's one thing Medicare might be missing. You have to hire nurse navigators. We actually built ambulatory surgery centers to decrease costs in conjunction with our partnership with the commercial payers nationally and locally. Technology. We really put a lot of effort and expense into these programs. And in the beginning with Medicare, we did really well. And then we didn't. And adding the fracture cases really hurt us as we acquired new practices. That didn't help us either. We really saw a huge decrease in our targets. And the ironic thing was our convener, we have a convener too. Our quality metrics and our utilization was top 10 percentile in the country, but we were losing a lot of money. So that was for mainly fracture care and total joint arthroplasty. We were doing okay with the other, we went in all procedures, and spine and shoulder and total ankle. And we were doing okay with that because, we had a little bit more low hanging fruit to work with, but we just didn't want to take the risk. And then as things went to the outpatient setting, that was a whole other ball game. Some of those cases were taken out of the bundle. I know they've been put back in, but that's something that we should consider advocating, that we have a special target price for outpatient Medicare patients. But it's been a struggle, but we have definitely stayed in our value-based programs on the commercial side and are doing very well. We're starting to get in some prospective bundles and more risk per member per month kind of arrangements. We're hoping to get that going in the next 2 years. So yeah, we just made a decision. It was just too risky for our practice, especially being in four states, and trying to manage 64 facilities that we operate in.
Right. And that's why we have Joel James with Signature here to talk about the work that a convener can do in aiding orthopedic surgeon members and practices and entering these kind of programs. So Joel, I understand that you help bear some of this risk. You help manage the relationships with CMS. What are some ways that you think the program could be improved for future model years?
Well, that's a really great question, Kristen. And I would like to say, here's the answer. I just want to go back and mention a couple of things, because I'm just hearing, from Chris and Dr. Lundy and Dr. Gibson, we are hearing this from the same similar stories from all our groups that we convene for. And it's not that different. There was a lot more success in Classic than so far in Advance for most groups, I would say. I think the biggest issue from, and I'm director of policy and government relations for Signature, from a policy perspective, is in these programs like BPCI, which is a voluntary program, And it's a policy-driven program. It's not you know, mandatory, and so it's not designed around administrative rules where you have to have public comment. And so they can make decisions, CMMI can make these decisions kind of on the fly and change policy, pretty much, and it can be really beneficial in a way, because it could be a beneficial policy change like we had in Classic. We had several changes that were done. Precedence was one where we didn't have precedence initially with hospitals that were in BPCI, and that was changed. As well as we got forbearance from losses because they weren't accounting for patient attribution correctly. And so those changes were able to be made really quickly. And we've told this to CMMI and CMS in many meetings, the biggest impediment to success in these programs for physicians, for physician groups, hospitals alike, is these quick changes in policy that might not seem that quick to policymakers in Washington. But, you know, when you're working cases and you're trying to project where you're going to be a year from now and your opportunity in a program like this, and doing the best to figure out the convoluted target pricing that they've come up with and how to calculate that, and then that change is kind of midstream, it really catches groups off guard, and it makes it very hard to sustain success in a program like this. And I think it was Dr. Lundy that was mentioning the service line groupings. That's a change that just came out a few months ago. It's going to be implemented model year 4, January 2021. And we have a lot of groups that basically are in that same boat. I don't know that we can go forward in the program since they're changing this particular aspect. So the policy changes, and it's, you know, conveners can really stay up on these, and we try our best to advocate, and AOS is been a tremendous supporter and certainly very beneficial in helping us in meetings and so forth on the Hill, as well as with CMI and CMS. But, they're only going to take it so far. They're only going to bend so far in these programs. And, the convener, as much as we try to protect our groups and do what we can to help them manage through what can be a very tricky process in managing a bundle payment program through Medicare, it can be a very daunting task because, again, orthopedics is just one type of episode class that they are looking across the board at all kinds of episodes and bundles around the country. Though we certainly take up a significant amount of spend on the surgical side. So it is a very high priority for them, but I will say it's been a pretty frustrating experience. So moving toward their decision to move toward mandatory brings up a whole nother set of issues, which I don't know if we'll have time to get into, but it raises a lot of issues.
Yeah, I actually want to get into that because I think that is the aspect of this topic that's so timely. If the agency, if they're considering making these bundled payment programs mandatory, I'm curious to know this group's perspective on how that may impact orthopedic surgeons. Before you answer, I just have to say, I know the AAOS is not in favor of them becoming mandatory. We really want our doctors to be able to choose to join these and have those flexibilities. But if that's the decision made from healthcare policymakers, it's one that we will have to adapt to and support our members in. So throwing it out there, who wants to start? You know, what's going to happen if this does become mandatory?
I think it's a bad idea to make it mandatory. We've seen what happened with CJR. The smaller private practices will never be able to keep up with that. You know, look at practices like, you know, ours that are on this call. we have a whole quality department. We have a whole population health department. It takes a lot to achieve success in these programs from a quality and a cost standpoint, especially when you're doing well. You know, you have to keep, you know, it's like a race to the bottom, and, you know, they should really look at restructuring a program. And I know AOS has been a huge advocate for that, but even down to looking at their quality metrics that make almost no sense from an orthopedic standpoint that they measure us on.
Kristen, this is Wilfred Gibson. And to, maybe to answer that and stay on the same theme, I agree the mandatory, and you said that the point that I was going to make, the AAOS does not support mandatory bundles. And I think what Chris said is that very true. When we started, or the Medicare started with the CJR, there was 75 metropolitan statistical areas, MSAs across the nation. Most of them were in urban areas around academic centers. And there was a number that immediately were cut out down to about 64. And then after that, they fell down to about 32. And I'm not even exactly sure now, but I think they're single or double digits, up to maybe 16 at the max, that are still up and running. And we've encouraged those to stay and for Medicare to keep them going, because we have a number of fellows having success in those bundle payment programs that are mandatory with CJR. But one size does not fit all. And the unfortunate thing with those mandatory bundles with CJR, they sometimes cut out others in the same community from being able to do a voluntary bundle because it has precedence, which leads to another subject about accountable care organizations we can talk about again. But I think the mandatory aspect is a bad idea. I think a number of groups, I'm not sure what would happen if they made it mandatory. It may have a negative impact on access for Medicare. I don't know that a number of private practice groups would continue that.
How about Dr. Lundy, Joel? I know we're wrapping up soon, so I just want to know if you all want to add anything more on maybe ways we could improve BPCIA Advance if it remains voluntary, and how those mandatory models, if they're our future, may impact our membership.
Yeah, Chris, I was chair of the Health Policy Committee of the Orthopedic Trauma Association, and we wrote a white paper on the shift bundle, which we haven't brought up yet, but that was the surgical femoral fracture and hip fracture bundle that was supposed to fix the whole hip fracture issue with CJR. And our white paper eventually was signed on by the OTA and then the association, and it went up to Department of Health and Human Services from there, strongly encouraging them. But the shift bundle didn't work. And as was brought up earlier, the fracture surgery, specifically the trauma patients, often will blow up bundles, even if you get it very well tightly controlled. And as you can look across the country, the practices that have a lot of variability, which, you know, is basically trauma surgery, tends to really wreck a lot of well-designed bundles and practices that really do a good job at it. And so making this mandatory, as we all know, politics is extremely local, right? Everything often occurs on the local level. And even though there are many similarities across the country, everybody's demographics are different and their systems are different. And if you don't have good downrange discharge plans and good ways to get people out with lower costs of care, and you can control the variability, such as from the fracture side, it doesn't really work that well. Ironically, we did pretty well with cost control under COVID, specifically with the fracture surgery, because all of a sudden, all the families wanted to bring grandma home. They didn't want her to go to a facility because they were afraid she was going to get coronavirus. And so all of a sudden, we were really easily able to get people out of the hospital and get them home under those plans, and didn't have to fight the families quite as much as we did before and now subsequently after.
I'm surprised we are just now mentioning COVID. You know, it's amazing how much has changed in this last year, not only for our members, but for healthcare as a whole. Joel, I want to go back to you in closing, because as a convener, you help surgeons like Dr. Lundy and Gibson sort through and navigate these decisions. What's your take on the future of these bundled payments for value-based care?
Yeah, I think I think there's a possibility. It may be narrow, but I think there's a possibility that they actually might work. I'm not, you know, we're opposed to mandatory bundles. Actually, CMMI has asked us for our opinions on some issues related, if they are mandatory, what has to happen. You know, pooling of risk is a really important issue that I think is pretty much overlooked. I think the idea that physicians are just going to take on financial risk is one thing that's been overlooked, I think, from the independent physician organization perspective. Because physicians are making, you know, they're using their own income, right, to get into these programs. They're hiring new staff. They're purchasing or helping build out and new analytic models. They're making all kinds of decisions financially that aren't really being taken into account in the model cost. And they're already at financial risk is one of the arguments I've made to CMMI. And then you have the discount that's taken on top of that just to get into the program. So CMMI and CMS have both clearly seen what happens when you force more and more groups to take financial risk, like they did with ACOs. They had a huge dropout a couple of years ago when they tried to accelerate the risk-taking in accountable care organizations. And something similar would happen in if you're going to make bundles mandatory and force greater financial risk, because I think the role of the convener has been important. I think we have a lot of groups have felt like we've provided, and other conveners have provided, valuable service in terms of navigating, as you said, Kristen, the bundle payment maze and kind of the convoluted nature of the program from target pricing and so forth. But I'm not sure they want conveners. I mean, CMMI, CMS wants conveners in program like this much longer. I think they want physicians to be taking more direct financial risk, which that's fine, but they also have to allow for more pooling of risk across physician groups for that, I think, to happen effectively. I also think, to me, bundle payments has demonstrated both in Classic and Advanced the real value of physician leadership in making not only the surgical decision, right, but managing with their case manager, nurse navigator, and so forth, the real care redesign that's gone in to create better outcomes. And they have created better outcomes for these patients than existed 10 years ago. But identifying physician leadership and changing this kind of ridiculous precedent structure, you know, where precedence is either timing driven or model driven, depending on what model you're in and when you got into it, that determines your precedence of whether, you know, you keep your patient in the program or they drop out. And as we have argued, since really in Classic, the patient and the physician relationship is paramount, and that should take precedence. If your patient's coming to you for a knee replacement and you happen to be doing a case at a hospital that's also in BPCI or is in CJR, and there's a different precedence rule and your patient's going to drop out of the program because of that, that makes zero sense. So if it's going to be, if they're, you know, and it sounds like they're seriously going to move toward mandatory programs, that model really has to change drastically because everyone's going to be in a mandatory program. So it's really, there's an opportunity, I think, to show real physician, physicians will gain greater autonomy in managing their patient across any kind of model. I don't know if that would happen, but that would be certainly the goal I think we should be shooting for, because physician leadership and autonomy has been proven at least in orthopedics, as far as I can see, in bundles and the kind of outcomes that have been achieved and the cost savings that have been achieved.
I love that note to end on, the physician autonomy and being able to lead these programs. That's definitely the highest priority of the AOS. So thank you all for coming on and having this really interesting conversation. It was great having all your different experiences with PPCIA and your different perspectives from your unique practices. So hopefully this gives AOS members some valuable points to consider. And I'll end by saying that we know many of our members are working in good faith to adopt these models, and where the thresholds for participation are too high and there's too many barriers, that's where your AOS comes in and your advocacy team in Washington. So reach out to us and learn more visiting AAOS.org under our Medicare payment and quality payment program issue pages. And we look forward to the next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Bone Beat from the American Association of Orthopedic Surgeons. For more information on this topic and other AAOS efforts to shape the future of musculoskeletal care, please visit AAOS.org/advocacy.